Hey friends, it's me again. You know what's really easy to do and even easier to forget? Help me out and hit that like button if you're listening on YouTube. If you're listening somewhere else, what the hell? Pop in and give me a thumb. Say hi while you're at it. Helps me a ton with that damn algorithm. And besides, it's always nice to see you there. All right then, let's hop on that crazy train.
All aboard!
Hey, welcome friends. Happy New Year. And most importantly, happy new season of Drew Blood's Dark Tales. How the hell we managed either of these milestones, I just can't explain. I guess an object in motion tends to stay in motion. No, Chester, I'm pretty sure that was Confucius. Isaac Newton invented those cookies. Anyway, come on in, friend. No one's here to talk about gastronomy. Hey, check out simplyscarypodcast.com and click the Patrons Area button. You get the entire catalog ad-free and available to download or stream for as little as $7.99 a month. Also, check out patreon.com/DrewBlood to support me personally. We've got a new episode of the Drew, Jeff, and Paul show up there, with more on the way.
I think you'll really enjoy it.
So tonight, we welcome back our old pal Gray Walker. In tonight's story, Jack has been hearing people's thoughts since he was 7, the same day his grandfather died. But when his grandmother's ghost attacks him searching for a mysterious book, Jack discovers his psychic gifts come with a price. So without further delay, from author Gray Walker, I give you Indigo Blood. When I was 7, I felt my grandfather die in his hospital bed. He had been in a coma, and the family had all agreed that pulling the plug was the best option. Words couldn't completely describe how it felt, and I honestly like to remember it, but I'll try to put it down. It was like being out of breath, be it from asthma, from running a marathon, from almost drowning, anything like that, only for that sensation of burning in your lungs to grow, and then all of a sudden, it just stops. I had blacked out for a while, then had woken up to the concerned, tear-streaked faces of my mom and dad. They told me I had begun screaming and crying uncontrollably in the waiting room before just stopping. At the time, they seemed to believe I hadn't fully digested the reality of Granddad's passing, chalked it up to a child grieving. I could suddenly feel their worry and pity for me along with the grief of losing my grandfather. I didn't tell them what happened. What could I say? I was 7. They hadn't believed in the bed and closet monsters I had always insisted on seeing. Why would they believe that I had just felt someone close to me die? After he died, strange things began happening to me. Or maybe I had only started to see them as strange after that. I could hear people in my mind. It wasn't that people were talking to me. I just heard whispers, murmurs, would see a few pictures, etc. It depended on how loudly people were thinking or how well I focused on a particular person. I did this a lot, focusing on people's minds, listening to their internal dialogue. Something funny I always noticed was that their thoughts seemed to take on weird variations of that person's voice, especially when they were being indecisive. Sometimes they were high-pitched, like they'd been sucking helium, and other times they were deep baritone voices, and lots of other kinds. I got a pretty good laugh from that. Then something happened when I was 9 that changed my life. It was a normal day after school. Because my house was just 2 blocks away from school, I was okay to walk home. I liked taking the back road because it was a good place to just unwind after school. I was about halfway between the house and school when I heard it.
Aberich.
I froze. I had heard people's thoughts enter my head, but this? No, this was too direct. I looked around, trying to discern where it had come from. All of a sudden, I was on the ground being dragged by... Well, I didn't see anything at all, but it felt like an iron grip on my ankle. I tried to scream, but it felt like an invisible hand was clasped around my mouth, too. Then I was lifted, and standing before me was an old woman, maybe in her 70s. She was dressed head to toe in a long, elegant green dress and a wide-brimmed hat of the same color. She had a scowl that made the wrinkles in her face that much more noticeable, and bloodshot eyes with cold, gray irises. The oddest and scariest part about her, though, was something that I had to do a double take at. Though I had to look closely to be able to tell, there was no doubt. The lady was transparent. She then spoke into my mind with a voice containing contempt and, oddly enough, desperation.
"Where is it?"
she hissed, as if expecting me to form a coherent response in my mind. I shook my head as best as I could in her grip, my head whirling in a vortex of half-formed pleas and questions, especially since she clearly had me mistaken for someone else. She didn't seem to like this, because her scowl only deepened.
"What have you done with the book, you monster?"
she snarled in my head. At this point, I felt a burning sharp sensation in the back of my head. It felt like some bizarre form of invasive surgery, like a metal rod being inserted into my brain and poking around inside. All at once, I could feel memories rush by my vision, birthdays spent with my family, and other such recollections. Soon enough, though, her focus seemed to shift to the memories of my granddad. She looked through it from my first memory of him to the incident in the hospital. Then came the worst part. I felt my memories of him being drained. It only started with a few trivial things, stuff that I would have forgotten about anyway, but somehow I realized what exactly she was doing. All of a sudden, I didn't feel scared anymore. I felt myself grow angry. Angry at the violation of my mind. Angry about being tortured over something I didn't know what she was even talking about. Angry that this old witch was trying to make me forget about my grandfather. Just angry. I finally mustered enough inner strength to form my thoughts into three comprehensible words. Leave me alone! The next events passed by in a moment. I imagined hurting her like this, seeing how she liked having a metal rod jammed in her brain. I then recall her suddenly giving a blood-curdling shriek and clutching her head. The rod left my head, and I remember the feeling of hurling through the air and hitting the ground. I blacked out, then woke up in a hospital bed with my parents beside me, their faces deeply concerned. The impact had caused my arm to be dislocated, but besides that, along with several hand-shaped bruises that doctors could only explain as some particularly rough bullies, I was deemed to be unharmed physically. Mentally, though, was a different story. Even 12 years after the incident, I was paranoid. It became difficult to go outside, let alone go to school. My parents were understanding about this. I was a 9-year-old who had been attacked. Why would I feel safe in public? They had to homeschool me up until college, which I took online for reasons not pertaining to the story. While I'd gradually been able to go out in public, I'd been on my guard, and embarrassingly enough, nearly had a panic attack every time I saw someone wearing the color green, and I had learned to be more cautious with my abilities. I thought that somehow my constant direct use of them alerted her to my presence. So I kept practicing with them, but rarely in public anymore. I didn't reach out into people's minds anymore, just letting their thoughts come to me instead. I had been reflecting on that incident and had realized something. That thing she was doing with my head was a mental probe. She was attempting to absorb memories of my grandfather to find something. Well, as it turned out, a few of my earliest memories of him were gone. Not that I'd forgotten about them. They're just gone. That wasn't all, though. From the looks of it, my own self-defensive probe took some of her memories. I saw some flashes. My granddad's house. Her speaking with him. Arguing with him over something I couldn't make out. An old worn book entitled Indigo Blood. And most strikingly of all, a black and white picture of the woman, younger, standing beside my grandfather, seemingly in his 20s. Minus the hat, she wore the same dress then, as well as a diamond ring. I instantly remembered that my grandfather had told me who that was when I was little. That was my grandmother. According to him, she had been missing for years. I didn't know if somehow my grandfather had something to do with her disappearance, but I soon got a call from my grandfather's lawyer, a man by the name of Carlos Ramirez. Driving to his office, I spoke with him. According to him, I was set to inherit Granddad's house and the belongings therein. Carlos gave me two envelopes left by my grandfather, not to be opened until I came of age. He said that one held a set of keys to the estate. The other contained information on my inheritance. Something was a bit strange about Mr. Ramirez, though. I didn't hear any thoughts escaping his mind, not even when I broke my rule and tried to subtly reach him. In fact, it felt like I was being barred from his mind. He didn't make any outward reaction. But on the way out, I did hear his voice in my mind say, "Read the letter before you open the chest in the attic." I didn't reply, mostly because I was surprised by hearing someone talk directly into my mind since the attack by my grandmother. It wasn't nearly as invasive, though. As cryptic as his instructions were, it just felt like the words had entered my mind as easily as mail through a door's mail slot. The trip to the old home was uneventful, thankfully. I arrived at the old home of my grandfather for the first time since before his coma and death. It looked just as I remembered, a little farmhouse, rustic yet comfortable in design. After unlocking the door, I took a step inside, and immediately my senses were hit with an overwhelming, bittersweet wave of nostalgia. I used to play here during summers. I used to walk in the nearby woods, my grandfather telling me all sorts of things about the fauna and flora. I used to laugh at my granddad swearing openly in front of me, much to my parents' chagrin. It was like I stepped back in time, but something was missing, or rather, someone. I didn't realize that I was crying until I felt a few tears run down my cheeks. I wiped them away quickly. There wasn't time for that right now. I needed to learn about what exactly my grandfather had hidden. I sat down at the old kitchen table and opened the first envelope, which contained a few sheets of paper with an all-too-familiar, messy handwriting on them.
"Hey, little cub. I know that by now you're too old for me to call you that. If you're reading this, I've kicked it, and you've probably started to hear weird shit in your mind. To cut to the chase, kiddo, you've got a gift, or a curse, depending on how you look at it. You're what's known as an indigo child, or just indigo. We can read people's minds, move things, and even send our minds outside our bodies. And that's just scratching the surface. You've probably noticed I said we, and that's because there are others like us. Some have powers that they aren't aware of. Others use their powers more subtly. There are even some damn famous people who are indigos. That's not the important part, though. that isn't why Carlos gave this letter to you. He gave this letter to you because your grandmother has woken up and is looking for you, or she's already found you. Now you need to go up to the attic, look for the trunk in the corner, and use the key to unlock it. I know you're confused, kid. I know all of this is crazy for you, but you'll have better answers than I can give when you see what's in the trunk. I'm sorry I can't give a better explanation than that, but hopefully it'll make more sense when you've read it. Know this, though. Whatever you do with your gifts, I know that you'll do what you believe is right. Love you, little cub. Granddad Jeremy.
Again, tears threatened to spill out at the use of the childhood nickname, but I blinked them back and looked at the keys, then at the attic. Inhaling the musty air in determination, I went up to the door, opened it, then searched the surprisingly clean attic for the trunk. I felt it before I saw it. Much like how I could hear people's thoughts, I felt the contents of the trunk call to me. Going over to it on autopilot, I knelt to examine it. There was nothing special about it, just a normal brown trunk covered in dust. Unlocking it, I saw it. The book I had never seen but remembered from my grandmother's memories. It was a leather journal with the two words, Indigo Blood. Beneath it was a hardcover book with the same name, though an odd compulsion told me the journal was the real one, with the hardcover being a decoy, no doubt. All of a sudden, I felt all sorts of things flowing into me. Words, images, memories, entire lives, including their deaths. It was as though many different people's minds had all been stitched together as one enormous consciousness, and I was being assimilated as well. It felt like an eternity, though it was really only a moment, but eventually I was able to pull myself back into the real world, panting heavily from the experience. Without opening it, I understood the book's purpose. This contained all of the information about indigos one would ever need, including names and entire histories. What's more, it somehow updated itself. When an indigo was born, they were added to it, along with their deeds. This wasn't what prompted me to take the book and immediately flee, however. During the assimilation, I happened to see an image of the house from the outside at that very moment. I didn't see anyone or anything as I peeled out of the driveway and back to my apartment, but I felt them. It wasn't my grandmother, but it was definitely someone who wished me harm. Back at my apartment, it took some time, but eventually I was able to keep the information from the book from just surging into my mind as it did the first time. It was written in an odd language that doesn't have any known roots, so it relies on indigos touching the pages and absorbing the information physically, like a psychic braille. According to the book, indigos are capable of a wide variety of mental abilities, and are capable of learning new ones rather quickly. They usually started the way I did, hearing people's thoughts. Usually, they learned telekinesis soon after, but as I never really practiced it in my youth and was kind of put off from using my abilities directly since my grandmother attacked me, I had never learned it until now. As it turned out, I was right in assuming that there were people other than my grandmother after me, and they wanted the book for some reason or another. As such, I took it upon myself to begin practicing with my abilities. That was when I heard my landlady, a kindly middle-aged woman named Ms. Lloyd, knocking on my door asking to be let in. I should have guessed that something was up by her voice. Usually she was very lively and cheery for her age, but she sounded rather spacey and aloof this time. I opened the door, and I barely had time to remember that she had mentioned she would be heading out today, and would I be a deer and water the plants by her own door before I felt the familiar sense of being lifted by invisible hands. In stepped five extremely ordinary-looking people, three men, two women, all dressed in everyday clothes. The one that I took to be the leader, a man wearing khakis and a navy blue sport coat, walked forward, then nodded at one of the women who was focusing on me intently. One detail I took notice of was the fact that they all had the same eye color, a strange dark blue. I was suddenly pressed to the floor by the invisible hands, and he walked closer and knelt at my level.
"Jack, isn't it?"
he asked affably, as if his compatriot wasn't currently pinning me to the ground by telekinesis.
"I'm Richard. This is Suzanne."
He nodded towards the woman keeping me pinned.
"And these are William, Robert, and Lucy. Sorry to intrude, but you've got something we want. So what?"
I began to open my mouth to yell at him, to shout for help, but I felt my mouth being clamped shut.
"Please don't interrupt, or Suzanne will tear your limbs off like a spider's, starting with your fingers and toes."
As if to emphasize this threat, I suddenly felt pressure on the aforementioned digits, and the woman in question gave a malicious sneer, as if she were desperate to do just that, whether I made a noise or not.
"Where was I? Oh yes, you have something we want. A book with the words Indigo Blood on it. Ring any bells? You can speak now, but not too loudly."
Sure enough, I felt the grip on my mouth release, and I spoke as coldly as I could in a futile attempt at hiding the fact that I was scared shitless.
"Why bother asking me with words? You could just probe my memories."
Richard chuckled, seemingly amused by the idea.
"Sorry, kiddo, but that doesn't really line up with our goals. See, we need your mind, memories, and all fully intact. A probe would disrupt that, and from our understanding, that wrinkly old bitch Eleanor made certain that you were unable to be read or stitched at a young age."
That gave me pause, which Richard noticed, opened his mouth as if to say something, then sighed and said,
"We're getting off the subject. Where's the book, kid?"
There was a gleam of malice behind his eyes and desperation. He and his crew needed the book. I didn't know why, but that didn't matter. All I cared about was getting out of that apartment building alive. I remembered the incident with my grandmother, the anger I felt at having my mind invaded, and I imagined driving an invisible metal rod into Richard's head. Just as it had happened before, the recipient clutched his head and screamed in agony, and I felt some brief flashes of memory enter my mind. Something I noticed, though, was the fact that the others had identical reactions simultaneously. I didn't have time to think it over, though, as Suzanne's grip was released, and I booked it for the window leading to the fire escape. Once I had descended the stairs, practically taking them three at a time, a stupid move given the rain, I found myself in the alley separating my apartment from a derelict factory. As I was scrambling towards the parking lot, though, I suddenly felt someone grab me from behind, apparently Robert. I struggled and kicked, and he lifted one arm, his hand poised to cover my eyes. It only took a moment, but I focused my mind on the hand and getting it away from me. There was a sound of skin, muscle, and bone being torn, and a feeling of blood splashing over me, followed by him releasing me. In the briefest of glimpses, I saw him stagger back as I ran, his hand now separated from his body, and him looking at it in mild annoyance. No pain, no shock whatsoever. I got into my car, reaching beneath the folded back seat. The book was still there where I had hidden it. Before they could round the corner, I gunned the engine and peeled out of the parking spot. On a whim, I drove back to my grandfather's house, then began to calm down from the situation and began to assess it more thoroughly. Apparently, those shards of memories were a lot bigger than I thought they were. Those five people were part of a group called the New Weavers. They were all linked together as a sort of hive mind, forming different parts of one enormous network using many different bodies. It did explain several things. For one, it explained why they all reacted to my probe at the same time. Two, it explained why Robert had little to no reaction to losing his hand. Physical things bother them, but attacks on the mind are different. Three, the stitching they mentioned was essentially adding people to their ranks. And four, my grandmother tried to murder every last one of them after they killed my aunt, her daughter. She had become enraged and attacked the Weavers, leading to her death. From what I'd gathered, the New Weavers seemed to worship some ancient race of beings that supposedly created the subtle link among all humans, the original Weavers. There was one more piece of information, though, that troubles me. Based on the intertwined memories and thoughts of these people, my grandfather was as much a thorn in their side as my grandmother. The thing was, he wasn't always that way because he fought them. He used to lead them. I should emphasize the word used. When they thought of him, I could feel nothing but waves of boiling hate and resentment, as well as hear numerous variations of traitor being used to refer to him. It was during this period of rumination that I saw a flash of green fabric out of the corner of my eye. And there she was. My grandmother, the old hag who had attacked me as a child. I thought I was ready for pretty much anything. Another mind probe. Her enraged spirit to come charging towards me screaming, something like that. I wasn't prepared for seeing her translucent form sitting on the old sofa, holding an old photo of her and Grandpa's wedding, a bittersweet smile spreading across her face, and tears running down her cheeks. Then she looked up at me, and the hateful, enraged witch encountered by my 9-year-old self was nowhere to be seen. Instead, there was a grandma. Everything positive one might associate with the word. She stood up and I instinctively flinched, again thinking back to that time. Her response was one of shame. She slowly, cautiously stepped forward. Why she needed to step is beyond me, and held her arms open. She didn't force anything. Didn't even seem to expect me to return the gesture, but seemed to hope I would. I'm not ashamed to admit that I cried when I hugged her. So many years had been spent not knowing who my grandmother was, living in fear of her, only for her to have me at her mercy and hug me as any grandmother would. After spending a minute or so crying in her arms as she tearfully whispered apologies to me, I eventually let go, offering a small smile to her. It was then that she sat me down, then began to explain the details of this whole thing to me. The New Weavers, as mentioned before, were a hive mind cult, and my grandfather used to lead them. Not only that, but he was the one who created the stitching process that made them into a hive mind, though it had started innocently. Members of the group would contribute some of their memories and allow their conscious minds to be woven together, independent but linked all the same. The idea was to make a process by which people could understand one another better, empathize with them, and create emotional bonds with one another that would put them on equal footing. No conflict, no resentment. Everyone would be able to live in peace with each other. The foundation of the stitching, the book. That was why I was able to track other indigos with it. She explained that certain members of the Weavers weren't content with simply creating bonds. No, they wanted control, to have people not sharing but carrying their thoughts and goals, adhering to them without question, even believing that they were their own thoughts. The worst offender was a man named Thomas Alberich. Control wasn't good enough for him, though. He wanted to use stitching to make extensions of himself, move his mind into people's bodies when he was near death. Alberich hypnotized my aunt, 12 at the time, into letting him try to weave one of his followers' minds with hers, but it ended up being too much for her, and she died. This was likely his way of getting back at my grandfather for trying to keep his goals down. Long story short, she died, my grandmother went berserk, and killed many of the new weavers, then attacked Alberich, and Alberich killed her. Enraged with Alberich, my grandfather too tried to kill him, only to find that he had already accomplished his goal of creating extensions. Instead of killing him, he took something from his own mind and wove it into the book, something needed to perfect the stitching. My grandfather fled with the book and his remaining daughter, my mom. When my grandma's spirit attacked me, it was under the assumption that Alberich had possessed or brainwashed me. I guess my accidental counterprobe was what snapped her out of it. When all of this was told to me, I needed time to come to terms with it, which Grandma gave me time to do. I thought I had figured out why they needed the book, but after thinking about that one weaver whose arm I tore off, it began to fall into place. Being one mind with many bodies was useful and all, but it didn't do much good to be in charge of bodies that were on a slow but inevitable path to decay. And the same applied to Alberich's own body. If he died, the new weavers would die with them. Before I could say anything else to Grandma, I saw that she had changed her expression. Now the enraged witch from my childhood was standing in front of me, only this time her wrath wasn't directed at me. She looked past me out the window, and I didn't need to be told who had arrived. Outside, pale blue eyes glowing in the dark, were 30 or so weavers, just standing eerily still. I knew why they were here, and I knew why they weren't coming in, not yet. They knew Grandma was here. I then heard a voice or voices speaking to my head, causing me to clutch my head in agony. They spoke in a tongue I hadn't heard before, but somehow recognized as the psychic braille the book was penned in. They said, "Give us the book, let us all be one." The people stood perfectly still, eyes glowing and never blinking. I spent the next few days focusing on improving my abilities and getting some helpful advice from Grandma. I learned to focus the telekinetic energy I used to tear that one guy's arm off. That was another thing. Grandma, for the newly revealed sweetness she had, recommended that I absolutely, positively not give any mercy to the weavers, let alone to Alberich. Vengeful feelings aside, I could see why she wouldn't be inclined to just knock them out. When I ripped the man's arm off, he didn't seem bothered by it, just mildly annoyed. If his thralls were able to shrug off major pain and continue fighting with their minds, the only solution would be to kill them. So I worked on sharpening that energy. By the time I had finished my training, I was able to clearly slice a target from 7 feet away. That was the point that I knew it was time to leave. I tried to convince Grandma to come with me, but she refused. She told me that since the first time I met her, and by the time she had regained her senses, she had anchored herself to the house. She didn't trust herself to be outside.
"And besides,"
she told me mentally,
"you've proven that you're capable of keeping the book and yourself safe."
It was a bittersweet departure. Hugs were exchanged, and tears were shed. But she told me how proud she was, as well as how sorry she was that all of this was pushed upon me. With that, I ventured outside, promising to come back when this was all over. The weaver's azure eyes gleamed in the dark from the trees as they watched me exit. I stood on the last porch step, waiting for a chance to make a break for my car, which was within the sphere she had made around the house and thus unharmed. They leered at me like wolves that happened upon a helpless fawn. Soon enough, my messenger bag flung over my shoulder, I darted for the car. Instantly, they began to run in my direction. Five of them came within 7 feet of me, prompting me to swipe my hand in a diagonal motion. Instantly, they were bisected from hip to shoulder. Using the surprise that the other weavers must have felt, I sprinted the remaining distance to the car, flinging the bag inside and starting it up. They began to gather behind me, but I wasted no time in reversing and killing at least seven. They, or rather Alberich, were confused, which I guess explained why they didn't attempt to attack me in the car. Not at first. Suddenly, a large tree limb was hurled in my direction, and I was just barely able to use my powers to slow it in midair. It still hit the car, putting a dent in the driver's side door, but I didn't let that concern me. I floored the gas pedal, leaving the driveway, the tires squealing onto the asphalt. I drove well above the speed limit until I made it back into the urban areas. It was during the subsequent hiding out in the city I had lived in for so long that I heard and felt something new. I had stopped at some cheap motel for the night, attempting to hide out from the weavers until I could think of a plan. I heard a million voices, and yet I heard only one voice speak into my head.
Let us be one.
The voice wasn't coaxing or demanding like the weavers, however. It was chillingly calm despite the loudness of the voice. Instantly, the room went dark, and I found myself in a black, empty void. Oh God, how I wish it had stayed that way. What I saw in the sudden indigo-colored light was a spider big enough to loom over the Burj Khalifa while lying down. It had at least 300 eyes, 24 legs, and 250 mouths, with many of the latter seeming to be huge, gnashing, grinning human mouths. That's the closest thing to an image I can describe the thing I saw. Somehow I understood what the hell that thing was. It was one of the original weavers, from which my grandfather's group adopted their name after Alberich took over. The creatures they had worshipped after his usurpation. The source of the indigos. And it spoke to me, its booming voice chillingly quiet and seething with malice.
Grandson of the usurped, you stand before the original weavers and you are found wanting. You and the usurped one have prevented the prophet from completing his web. We command you, give unto him the tome in your possession. Let us be one.
Then the light grew brighter. The void was filled with bizarre shift in architecture, the functions of which I couldn't begin to fathom. And stretching further than my eyes could see were countless more of those arachnids, each one possessing features that should have been impossible. Then they all began to chant those four maddening words.
Let us be one. Let us be one. Let us be one. Let us be one.
Before long, they had begun to screech, snarl, and roar the phrase at me. I was petrified. I tried to move, to resist the mental attack, just a fucking scream, but nothing came from me. Not until the motel room spontaneously appeared again. At that moment, I screamed so loud that I'm almost certain I woke the whole motel up. It took time, but after the mind-rending experience with the original weavers, I took a moment, a long moment, to think things over. It made sense that they were able to contact me. My energy had been spent fighting the new weavers. I had put so much focus on the offense, I forgot to put up my mental barriers again. Of course, I get the feeling that those things could have entered my mind any time they wanted. After taking some time to reconstruct and reinforce the barriers around my mind, I decided to use my abilities to search for any new weavers who might be in the motel. It was a risky move, but I had to be sure that I was alone. To my relief, there weren't any. To get a more precise read on the locations of any new weavers, I looked in the book,
For anyone who doesn't remember, this book lists the names and locations of anybody with the abilities of an indigo. They were scattered all over the city, going from place to place. They knew I had the book, so I guess they were hoping to confuse me and get me by surprise. Something else hit me, something that had never occurred to me until then. As I looked at one of the names of the indigos Alberich had stitched, I vaguely recalled seeing the name on a missing poster. On a hunch, I checked other names online. Sure enough, in numerous obituaries and other locations, all of them were either reported as missing or dead. That was how he was able to amass so many followers. He faked their deaths or disappearances and stitched them, then hypnotizing any witnesses or erasing the memories of anyone who saw their faces, maybe having the bodies undergo plastic surgery or something like that. Either way, he caused all of them to disappear from the public eye and took away their minds. There was one that was standing still, however, and it was standing in a place that caused goosebumps to pop up all over my body. Granddad's grave. The psychic energy emitted from this new weaver was stronger than the others. It was Alberich. It had to be. But what was he doing? Trying to find something else Granddad left behind? The only relief I had was that he and the rest of the weavers avoided the house my grandmother still lived in. Still, I felt my fear burn into a searing rage at the audacity. He took the group my granddad made and changed it into a cult, caused my aunt's death, twisted my grandmother's mind and forced granddad to kill her, and now was trying to come after me to get this book. What I did next was a stupid decision, but I couldn't help it. Whatever he was doing at the graveyard, I was going to stop him. So I checked out of the motel, got into my car, and sped towards the cemetery. Several pairs of glowing blue eyes tracked my car, but I didn't care. I had already killed several. I'd kill more if I needed to, and I'd certainly kill Alberich. Murder is wrong. But I didn't give a damn. This fucker lost any opportunity for mercy after what he had done to my family and countless others. I wasn't a superhero after all. I was just a traumatized, pissed off psychic who's been listening to people's thoughts his whole life, got attacked by the confused ghost of his grandma, and is being hounded by worshippers of giant eldritch spiders. I had some rage to vent. Arriving at the dark cemetery, I got out of the car. I knew this could be a trap, but if there was even the slightest chance to get my hands on Alberich, I'd take it. Sure enough, there was a figure standing beside Granddad's grave, the whole thing having been dug up and the coffin lying open with the body inside having decayed long ago.
"Alberich, you bastard!"
I shouted, getting ready to block any psychic attacks from him.
"I knew this would get your attention," he said in a smooth, serpentine voice.
Turning around calmly, I was met with a face simultaneously familiar and foreign to me, even in the dark. I froze in my tracks, anger forgotten and replaced by numbing shock and confusion. The lips were curved into a condescending, arrogant smirk. His attire was a lot more formal than he ever would have liked, and the eyes were, of course, blue and shining, but there was no mistaking it. I struggled to find my voice, staggering back slightly, then eventually stammered.
"Granddad?"
He chuckled lightly and shook his head.
"No, not exactly, little cub."
Hearing his old nickname for me, leaving the lips of this man slammed into me like a ton of bricks.
"How did..."
"I'm guessing you didn't see the part in the book about excision, did you?"
I remained silent.
"Didn't think so. Figured Jeremy would have blotted that from the book. See, sweet Eleanor probably told you I was Jeremy's old pal. Apprentice, whatever.
All of that was technically true. What she forgot, what I made her spirit forget, was that your granddad made me. He had certain emotions he thought would undermine his leadership of the Weavers. Anger, fear, pride, ambition, perfectionism. He took all of those and others and excised them from his mind, then used them to make me, but left enough in himself to still act like a regular human being. See, kid, indigos are a hell of a lot more than psychics and spoonbenders. We've got gifts from beings older than time itself. We're as close to gods as you can get, just below the original Weavers. Rearranging some molecules here and there to make a perfect copy of yourself isn't out of the realm of possibility if you're strong enough and willing to undergo pain like nobody's ever imagined. He was. And so here I am. My legs buckled and I fell to my knees, shock enveloping me. Sighing, he patted me on the shoulder. Lot to take in, isn't it? Can't blame you. Not every day you meet the exact copy of your dead grandpa. But chin up, son. You and me, we're going to shake things up.
We?
I croaked out. Yeah, your granddad's original idea to weave people's minds together was what drove me, but he was afraid of actually going through with it. He was too afraid of getting in contact with the original Weavers. That was why he excised me, leaving me with only a rudimentary idea of how to do so as a last resort. I was the lock. He was the key, so to speak. But now you have the book. Now we can finish what Jeremy never had the courage to do. What do you say, son?
I just knelt there, numb with shock. He was right. This was too much to take in at once. When I finally composed myself, I stood up, then looked at Alberich, who held his hand down, as if he genuinely expected me to take it.
Fuck you!
I growled, clenching my fists as rocks around me began rising into the air. He blinked in surprise.
What?
You absorb innocent people's minds into yours. Come after me. Try to do the same. Dig up my granddad's grave, and all of that after what you've stolen from my family, and you think I'm going to join you? After everything you've put me and my family through?
I hurled the rocks at him, intent on reenacting the biblical Stephen's death, only for them to remain suspended in the air. Alberich sighed, then clicked his tongue.
So disappointing. Seems you take up after your granddad more than I thought. A bleeding heart through and through. Guess I'll have to do this the hard way.
He placed a hand on my forehead, and instantly the rocks fell. I felt the sensation I felt when touching the book, but this was different. He was replacing my broken memories with different ones. He was trying to make my mind whole again, whole enough to help with whatever insidious plan he had concocted to bring the original Weavers into the world. No, not just that. He was trying to absorb the book as well. Everything I'd read, all of the names listed, everything. He wanted it all. Suddenly, my car plowed through the graveyard to both mine and Albert's shock. It struck him, then sent him into the hole he dug up. I heard a voice in my mind saying, "Get in now." The door swung open, and already I could see Alberich starting to climb out.
"No,"
I said. Alberich clambered out of the hole rather spryly for an old man, muttering a slur directed at Carlos.
then looked at me, outraged, directing the blast of psychic energy at me. I was barely able to deflect it before sending one back at him. Carlos, realizing that I had no intention of leaving, exited and joined in the fight. We alternated between throwing headstones, tree limbs, and striking with psychic-empowered punches and kicks. All three of us gave as good as we got, soon bloody and panting, all while the new weavers watched with glowing blue eyes.
The weavers are coming, boy!
Alberich rasped.
Give me the book!
As if on cue, a tear opened up behind him. All the three of us could do was stare in awe. There was the Weaver's Void, and there were the original Weavers. They began their chant, more demanding this time. That was when I came upon an epiphany. My granddad had locked away secrets of the original Weavers in the book to prevent them from gaining a foothold in our world, and they wanted Alberich to find those secrets. Opening the door, I summoned the book telekinetically. Alberich seemed to gain an expression of relief, while Carlos was horrified. I held the book open, letting him view the pages. I let him gain a glimpse of the understanding he had been so eager to possess, and I watched his relief and elation turn to utter horror as I destroyed the book. He howled in defeat before a voice cut in.
You have failed, Prophet. We will find another way.
Alberich turned to the portal, shaking his head. Before he could even begin to plead his case, a long tendril of purple energy lashed out, pulling him in. He tried to reach out to take me with him, but two transparent, wrinkled hands appeared on each side of me. I looked back and forth. It was Granddad and Grandma. They both smiled at me as they then pushed Alberich in. I don't know what the original Weavers did with him, but I heard his screams, and I heard the screams of the new Weavers as they all began dying with their master. This time I listened to Carlos when he said we had to leave. I looked at my grandparents' spirits, not knowing what to say, but they gestured at me to leave. As I did, though, I heard both of their voices say, "We love you, little cub. Now go." Doing my best not to let my tears get the best of me, I got into the car as Carlos peeled out. Once we were on the road, I pulled out the leather journal, which caused Carlos to do a double take. I explained the decoy left in the old chest, to which he laughed, calling my granddad a wily old bastard to the last. We drove out of the state, eventually stopping at a hotel. On the news, there was coverage of a wrecked cemetery with the bodies of many missing persons lying dead under mysterious circumstances. Apparently, after Alberich was killed, the memories of these people had returned to the non-indigos. On the one hand, I was glad that their loved ones could gain closure, but on the other, I wished it hadn't come in such a bizarre, horrific manner. I hardly knew what to believe at that point. I knew one thing, though. When he began trying to stitch me, I heard that familiar mantra, "Let us be one." He was their prophet and puppet, with the difference between him and his own puppets being that he had enough free will to want to serve them, whereas his slaves had their will taken from them. Sometimes I wish I had never received these powers. They had brought me nothing but trauma. Because of them, my grandmother attacked me. My grandfather's old cult attacked me. I began questioning everything I'd ever known about the man. And to top it all off, I was being tormented by giant eldritch spiders who want to feast on human psychic energy. There's so much I still don't understand. I still don't know what parts of my grandparents' and Alberich's stories are true and untouched by mental manipulation. But now I know that, trauma or no, I need these powers. The original Weavers said that they would find another way. Whether they intend to groom another prophet, I'm not sure. But Granddad died believing that I would do what I believed was right with the gifts given to me. And even if these gifts come from the original Weavers, I'll use them to keep them out of our world, just as Granddad did, but without making the same mistakes. And if there's anyone else out there trying to stitch as Alberich did, I'll end it. It's my duty as an Indigo. And that was Indigo Blood by author Gray Walker. A good reminder to let the estate sale handle Grandpa's old books. A little about the author. Old Gray says he's only a writer in the sense that he writes stuff and people read it. Fair enough. His favorite genres of writing are sci-fi, fantasy, horror, or some mix between those. His biggest inspirations are Stephen King, Cormac McCarthy, Isaac Asimov, William Gibson, Harlan Ellison, and fellow Reddit authors Elias Witherow, C.K. Walker, no relation, and Matt Demersky. He has a Reddit account, reddit.com/user/mr-gray42, and a WIP website where some of his writings can be found, thegraywalker.wordpress.com. Thanks, Gray.
And do old Drew Blood a favor, would you? Subscribe to his podcast wherever you do your listening and leave him a 5-star review and a kind word, even if you're listening on YouTube. He needs soldiers on all fronts to win this battle, and he appreciates it. To hear a premium ad-free edition of tonight's and all the other episodes, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click Patrons in the upper menu. You'll find yourself at ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com, where you can become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to their entire audio archive, all ad-free and available to download or stream. Thank you for your time and for supporting our sponsors. When you support our sponsors, you support this show. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all the latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with them each and every week. Oh, and you can find Drew Blood on Facebook and Instagram, and sometimes Twitter. The Drew Blood's Dark Tales podcast is accepting submissions, friend. If you've got a story or two you'd like to be featured on the show, send it to drewbloodhorror@gmail.com. If selected, you'll get the full treatment, 10 bananas.
Well, I'm afraid this is where we part ways, at least till next week. So grab a drink for the road, friend. You earned it. Listening to Lil' Old Me until the 10th season, here's to another 10. So may the wind be at your back, and may the road rise up to meet you. And may patreon.com/drewblood shine warm upon your face. Also, a big thank you and shout out to all my sweet, wonderful patrons. I love you all. And thank you for supporting me and being there for me. And if you haven't joined up yet, you're missing out on a pretty damn funny talk show between me, Jeff, and Paul. We have a pretty good time. Y'all ought to stop by sometime. Also, go fuck yourselves. All right. Good night, y'all.